Today I'll be talking about some work that I've been doing on modeling the gravitational wave emission of dynamical capture binaries, and this is work that has already been published in the two archive papers listed below, and there will be a third coming out probably at the beginning of December. So usually I start these talks off by presenting some of the quasi-circular in-spirals that LIGO has detected. But recently, LIGO detected what could plausibly be described as the first dynamical capture binary, which is the event GW190521, which was the short burst of radiation coming from the merger and ring down of a high mass, two high mass black holes with total mass of about 150 solar masses. LIGO's analysis suggested that the most likely scenario for the formation of this binary was that of a highly spinning, spin-processing binary, quasi-circular as well. However, there's been a number of studies, specifically these two, since the detection, that have sort of poked holes in this, and that have suggested that models with non-negligible eccentricity are slightly more favored over the quasi-circular spin-processing models. Now, this is only slightly, and it's not enough to completely be able to distinguish this as a dynamical capture binary, but this does sort of open up the idea to LIGO actually being able to see these sorts of binaries. Now, where might this sort of system have come from? In recent years, there's been a lot of work trying to characterize these binaries formed in dense stellar environments, which come from a host of interactions, such as single-single gravitational wave captures, as well as chaotic three-body interactions. And most of these studies have focused on globular clusters, where the distribution of eccentricities at the LIGO detection band are plotted here. And for the purposes of this talk, the most relevant one is the red distribution, which comes from gravitational wave capture. So this is where you have two black holes on an unbound orbit. They come through closest approach and emit gravitational waves, causing the binary to become bound. Now, these binaries can form with a wide range of eccentricities, but you might notice that there is a spike at very high eccentricities, eccentricities close to one. So you can actually form highly elliptical binaries via this method of gravitational wave capture. Now, this is not the only way of forming these types of binaries. You can also have hierarchical triples, which might form in active galactic nuclei, where resonances, such as the Kozai-Lidov resonance and the post-Newtonian resonances, can force a trade-off between the mutual inclination angle of the third body with that of the orbital eccentricity of the inner binary. And this will generically push the eccentricity to very high values, very close to the unbound limit. Now, globular clusters, as I said, are probably the most well-studied, and from those studies, we know that the event rate is roughly 1 to 2 per year for eccentric signals from globular clusters. So these are expected to be very rare events, and around 10% of these events are expected to be highly eccentric. Now, most of these dynamical capture signals will not look like the GW190914 type of, the GW190521 type event. Instead, these binaries are expected to form at lower masses, around maybe 10 solar masses, and will instead go through some sort of in-spiral phase before it reaches merger and ring down. And I have plotted here a number of in-spiral waveforms across a range of eccentricities. Now, one way of characterizing these waveforms is to convert them into sound to sort of give you a picture of what these waveforms are like. So starting at the very top, we have a quasi-circular waveform in red, which sounds something like this. Hopefully you could all hear that. And what you hear is that the frequency of the wave increases and the wave gets louder. So this is the characteristic chirping pattern that we expect from most signals that LIGO has been detecting. Now, if you go up in eccentricity to something that's moderately elliptical, so an eccentricity 0.5, which is the blue and gold waveform, you get something that sounds like this. You sort of notice that in the early parts of that signal, it sounds almost kind of like a motorcycle. And the reason for this is because eccentricity generically excites higher harmonics of the orbital period, as opposed to the quasi-circular waveforms, which only have the second harmonic. So what you end up with is this beating pattern between different harmonics of the orbital period, and that's what creates this noise. However, as the binary end spirals, it also loses eccentricity. So by the time the thing reaches the end of the end spiral, it sounds more like the chirping pattern of the quasi-circular binaries. However, if we push the eccentricity even louder to the bottom two waveforms, which are at an eccentricity of 0.9, you instead get a sound like this. You may notice that the start of this waveform doesn't really sound like the continuous waveforms of the quasi-circular and moderately eccentric waveforms. Instead, you get this ticking behavior, which almost sounds like a heartbeat. The reason for this is because the gravitational wave power scales like some high velocity of the system. And so the velocity of the system for highly elliptical binaries is largest at pericenter passage and can actually be orders of magnitude larger than the velocity when they are farthest apart. So what this means is that gravitational waves get concentrated into a burst of radiation during closest approach, which we call pericenter passage. And instead of getting this continuous signal, you instead get a repeated burst signal, with bursts being emitted at every closest approach. Now, before I get into discussing how we go about modeling these sorts of systems, it's useful to discuss how you would go about detecting these sorts of things. And historically, for these highly eccentric binaries, the technique that has been considered has been power stacking, where you assume that there's some set of bursts contained in your signal, and you stack the power in each burst in order to amplify the signal of noise of the total signal, with the amplification scaling like the number of bursts to the 1/4 power. What this means is that if the bursts are very weak, like they are expected if the binary is sufficiently far away, so say S and R1, you need about 10,000 bursts to achieve detection, where here I'm quantifying detection as achieving an SNR of 10. It's not obvious that you get 10,000 bursts from all of these systems, so this is sort of a suboptimal strategy for trying to detect these sorts of things. However, optimally, what you want to do is to use matched filtering, whereby you can create a waveform model that is a very accurate representation of the types of signals that you're trying to detect, and you filter the data with this waveform model in the hopes of achieving detection. The main trouble with these repeated burst signals is that we don't have the most accurate models available, because there are currently very few numerical waveform simulations, numerical relativity waveforms, that cover this high eccentricity regime. Now, as somebody who works on analytics, I sort of want to create optimally an analytic waveform model that I can use to achieve detection. And what this really means is that we want fast frequency domain waveforms. Why do we want them to be analytic? Well, generically, analytic waveforms are typically faster to evaluate than numerical waveforms. And this is almost always true for numerical relativity, but is especially true, especially if you're trying to integrate the equations of motion of some approximate space-time. Second, why you might want to consider analytic waveforms is that you have analytic control over the physics that is put into the waveform models. So for example, if you wanted to include tidal effects in your waveform models, all you would do is take the binary black hole waveforms and go out and calculate what the tidal effects are in terms of some subset of parameters and put this into the waveform model. And then all you have to do is vary the parameters for every equation of state that you want to consider. Whereas if you were to do numerical simulations, you would have to repeat the simulations for every single equation of state that you wanted to consider. The downside to doing analytics is that you need to assume some sort of approximation, because we can't solve the full general relativistic two-body problem exactly. So this, for ground-based detectors, means working within the post-Newtonian approximation. So the first half of this talk, I will discuss the creation of what I call effective flyby waveforms for binary black holes. And the reason why I refer to these as effective flyby waveforms is because the approximations that go into them generically break the periodicity of the highly elliptical orbit. So rather than describing this as a periodic orbit, you instead describe them as an effective unbound flyby. Now, before I actually get to the waveform models that I've developed, it's useful to consider a basic example that most people will be familiar with, and that is the quasi-circular Taylor F2 model. I won't go through all of the steps in detail of how you actually construct this, instead present just a basic overview. And the idea is, as the binary end spirals, it emits some flux of gravitational radiation, and you assume some balanced law which then relates the loss of orbital energy to the flux of gravitational waves and allows you to write down a set of basic radiation reaction equations that describe how the radius of the orbit and orbital phase change as a function of time. You go out and you solve these equations, you stick them in the time domain waveforms, which is only characterized by the second orbital harmonic, and then what you want to do is you want to analytically Fourier transform them. In order to do this, you need to make use of the stationary phase approximation, or the SPA, and to give an idea of what this is for those who may not be familiar, this SPA is a generic technique for evaluating Fourier integrals of this form, where you have some amplitude function of time and some phase function psi. Now, these functions can be arbitrarily complicated, but the point is that if you plot this phase function, you might get behavior that's sort of like this, where the integral is highly oscillatory on the edges of your integration domain, but somewhere in the domain, the phase reaches some maximum value and becomes very flat. And the idea is that the integral is dominated by this region around what we call the stationary point, where some number of derivatives of the phase vanishes. Because the integral is dominated by the region around the stationary point, you can expand the phase in a Taylor expansion about it, and then you can go out and analytically calculate this Fourier integral, regardless of how complicated it is. Now, if you do that for the quasi-circular waveforms, what you get is something like this. So h tilde of f is the frequency domain waveform. It scales like f to the minus 7/6, and you have this phase function psi, which is dependent upon the Fourier frequency. Now, to break this down a little bit, this is dependent on these two parameters, tc and phi c, which are referred to as the time and phase of coalescence. And these are free parameters. Whenever you do any sort of analysis with this waveform, what you would do is maximize over these two parameters. Here, calligraphic M is the chirp mass of the binary. This is just the characteristic mass that almost always enters every post-Newtonian waveform template. And these phi I are post-Newtonian coefficients. And this is actually important because you might notice that this thing's written in combinations of pi times the chirp mass times f. And if you study the orbital mechanics of the binary, what you realize is that that's actually dependent, it scales like the orbital velocity of the system. So this thing actually constitutes a post-Newtonian parameter, and the phase is written in a post-Newtonian expansion. And this will be important when contrasting to the effect of flyby waveforms. So now that you have a clear picture of how we go about constructing these waveforms, we can consider these effective flyby waveforms. So the first step is that you need to solve the radiation reaction equations. And I want these waveforms to be an accurate representation of the burst that is emitted from a highly eccentric binary. So the obvious thing is, well, these bursts are emitted at pericenter. So the obvious thing to sort of try is, well, do a Taylor expansion about pericenter of the radiation reaction equations and solve them. If you do this, you end up with something like this. So here P is what's referred to as the semi-lattice rectum. You can sort of think of this as the analog of the impact parameter for unbound orbits. And for the remainder of this talk, I'll refer to this as the impact parameter. E is the orbital eccentricity. And because we're working for highly elliptical binaries, this will be very close to one. And I've written these two variables as Taylor expansions in terms of L, as I will show in the next slide. These actually end up being very simple functions of L, and you use L to describe all of the time dependence of the system. So these coefficients dpdl and dedl are what are described by the balance laws from gravitational radiation, which once again relate the loss of orbital energy to that of the flux of gravitational radiation. So if you know what the flux of gravitational waves is, which we know in post-Newtonian theory, you can go on, you can calculate these things. On the other hand, L prime of t is described by this very simple differential equation where n and frr are two characteristic frequencies of the system. So n scales like 1 over the orbital period, so this is roughly the orbital frequency of the orbit, and frr scales like 1 over the coalescence time scale, so this is like what I call the radiation reaction frequency. Because the coalescence time scale is very long compared to the orbital period, frr is smaller than the orbital frequency. And if you take the ratio of these two things, what you find is that this thing actually scales like the velocity of the system to the minus fifth power. So this ratio of these two frequencies actually becomes your new post-Newtonian parameter. And because this is purely a constant variable, your post-Newtonian parameter is no longer dependent on eccentricity. This doesn't happen in quasi-circular binaries. Now you can solve this differential equation and you find that L, I should have said that this is the mean anomaly. It's the phase variable that describes how eccentric binaries evolve in time. And you find that L is this exponential function in time. Now, plotted here is a comparison of these approximations over a single orbit for a binary with impact parameter of 20m and eccentricity 0.99. So on the left, you have E as a function of L, and you can see that the numerical evolution, which is the black line, is a fairly linear function, that the analytic Taylor expansion matches this fairly well. In the bottom panel is the relative error between these two approximations, and you see that the relative error is less than 10 to the minus 4 across the entire orbit, which is actually kind of surprising because this expansion is supposed to be only valid at pericenter. In the middle, you see the same thing for the impact parameter as a function of L. And on the right, you have the evolution of L as a function of T, which has a slightly different behavior. So it is very accurate at pericenter, which occurs at T is equal to zero, but the two solutions dephase as you move away from pericenter. And this isn't that unexpected. This is an approximation that is most accurate around pericenter. As I will show, this dephasing as you move away from pericenter, it does not introduce a significant amount of error in the waveform model. And I'll show that in a few slides. So the next thing you do is you write out your time domain waveforms and you put in these radiation reaction effects. For eccentric binaries, the time domain waveforms can be written out like so. So here M is the chirp mass of the system and DL is the luminosity distance. And I've decomposed this thing in a Fourier series in terms of harmonics of the orbital period. That's why this depends like e to the IKL. Now these EK coefficients are purely functions of the eccentricity. And if you're calculating this, the leading post-Newtonian order, these things depend on Bessel functions of this form, where J prime is the derivative of the Bessel function with respect to its argument. Now, once you have this down, you can ask, well, can I Fourier transform this thing by method of stationary phase? And it does turn out that there is a stationary point in the first derivative of the phase of the Fourier integral, which becomes this. So your TP is the time of pericenter passage. And this thing depends on frequency logarithmically, as opposed to the quasi-circular case where this would be a power law. And so you can calculate the Fourier transform analytically and you get something that looks like this. So here I've rewritten everything in terms of this new variable chi, which is the Fourier frequency divided by the radiation reaction frequency. And the frequency domain waveform scales like chi to the minus 1/2, which is fairly typical behavior of the stationary phase approximation. You now have a new phase variable psi, which is given at the bottom of the slide. And I'll break this down a little bit. So instead of having a time of coalescence, you now have a time of pericenter passage. And this is still a free parameter. So if you were to use this waveform in any sort of data analysis, you would maximize over this time. On the other hand, you no longer have a phase of coalescence. Instead, you have this thing called chi orb, which is chi evaluated at the orbital frequency. And this thing is purely and totally determined by the orbital parameters of the binary. It is no longer a free parameter. And in actuality, this thing scales like n divided by FRR. So this is actually your PN parameter. And finally, the frequency dependence in the phase is no longer a power law like it was for quasi-circular binaries, and instead becomes more complicated, specifically as logarithmic dependence. Now, the main trouble with this waveform is this decomposition in terms of harmonics of the orbital period, because you have to worry about this infinite summation. Why is this a problem? Well, for low and moderately eccentric binaries, these Bessel functions actually behave like delta functions whose amplitude decays very rapidly as you go to increasing k values. What this means is that if you're working to low and moderate eccentricities, you can cut these sums at some finite number of value and retain very high accuracy compared to a numerical waveform. However, if you're working at very high eccentricities, so eccentricities close to one, these Bessel functions change their behavior. And in fact, they become exponentially decaying with a very long tail. So what this means is that you need to include many, many terms in the summation in order to achieve something that is sufficiently accurate compared to numerical waveforms. So this is sort of a problem with these eccentric waveforms. Fortunately, as a graduate student, I worked on a procedure for resumming these types of summations. And the idea is you replace these Bessel functions J with their asymptotic expansion about K goes to infinity. And here capital K is the modified Bessel function of the second kind, and zeta is a function that is purely dependent upon the eccentricity. Once you do this, you can replace the summation with an integral. And this is valid to do in the limit as k goes to infinity because the separation between harmonics becomes infinitesimal in that limit. Now, this by virtue of doing this asymptotic expansion, you can actually analytically evaluate these integrals in closed form, and you get something that looks like this. So here, the frequency domain waveform depends on an amplitude, which is function frequency, which I will not write out explicitly, but it depends on this 2F1 hypergeometric function where L1, L2, and S are real numbers. Chi is once again your frequency variable, and X is your new PN parameter. So this thing scales like high orb, and so it scales like the orbital velocity to the minus fifth power. Now there's a problem with this waveform. Even though it's analytic and in closed form, you don't have to worry about this infinite summation anymore. If you try to throw it on a computer and sample it, it takes around 10 hours to evaluate this. If you recall, I said at the beginning of this talk that analytic waveforms are usually faster than numerical waveforms. Well, this might be the one counterexample. Fortunately, I'm kind of stubborn about these sorts of things, and I decided to try to find a way to speed this up. And there is a way of doing this. Namely, you realize that this chi variable is large. So chi, if you recall correctly, is the Fourier frequency divided by the radiation reaction frequency. For systems that are in ground-based detectors, the radiation reaction frequency is typically around a decahertz or less, while the Fourier frequency is at 10 hertz or more. So what this means is that chi is generally large for ground-based sources, and you can perform an asymptotic expansion of these hypergeometric functions to obtain a new, simpler waveform written here. So here, a bar are new amplitude functions, which are Lorentz series in Fourier frequency, and the hypergeometric functions have now been replaced with Bessel functions with this complex phase variable, which is also a Lorentz series in the Fourier frequency. Now, this waveform looks kind of complicated. To show you an illustrated example what this waveform looks like, I plot that here for a system with an impact parameter of 20 m and eccentricity 0.99. And I compare this to a leading PN order numerical waveform, which is given in the black here, and the analytic waveform is given in the red. And you can see that these two waveforms lie pretty much right on top of each other. And at the bottom panel, I show the relative error between these two. So for very high frequencies, you're getting about a 1% error in the waveform, while at low frequencies, you're getting about a 10% error. But it's mostly due to the fact that the waveform decays like a power law at low frequencies. Now, while it is useful to do these sorts of comparisons, what you really want to do is quantify the level of error that your approximations put into the waveform via a single number. And the way that we do this is to use what's referred to as the match. So the match is given by the inner product between two waveforms, HA and HB, which is computed by this frequency domain integral here, where SN of F is the noise of the detector. And to get the match, what you do is you maximize this inner product over the time and phase shifts of your waveform model. In this case, I only have a time shift, so that's all I maximize over in this case. The match you can sort of think of as a dot product between two vectors. If the waveforms are 90 degrees out of phase, then the match is zero. If the waveforms are completely in phase, then the match is one. And in that case, the waveform is an exact approximation of your numerical exact answer. So doing this calculation for a wide range of systems, so from eccentricities 0.7 all the way up to 0.9, and impact parameters from 10m to 60m, you get these sorts of results. And for convenience, I've plotted contours of matches of 0.99 and 0.98 and 0.97. And what you see from this is that the match generally increases as you go to higher eccentricities. This makes sense because the approximations are most well-defined at high eccentricities, and they're generally increases as you go to lower impact parameters. Now the match drops off for very large impact parameters due to an issue related to having to apply a high frequency cutoff to the analytic model, but I won't get into that in any significant detail here. When considering waveform models for detection, usually one sets a nominal match value that the waveforms have to achieve in order to use them for detection. And usually this is chosen at 0.97 because the match is actually related to the loss in number of signals that you would lose in a search if you were to use these waveform models. Loss in number of signals scales like 1 minus the match cubed. At 0.97, you lose roughly 10% of signals. So if your model is getting matches above 0.97, then you can say that there's not really a significant amount of error in your waveform model. And that's exactly what we find here. Now, so far, we've only focused on single bursts from a single pericenter passage. You might ask, well, what is the use of that when these binaries will go through many pericenter passages as they inspiral? So you can sort of ask the question, well, can we combine multiple of these single effective flyby waveforms to create full inspiral waveforms? And the answer is yes, when you realize that these effective flyby waveforms are characterized by three parameters that evolve under radiation action, namely the time of pericenter passage, the eccentricity, and the impact parameter. So if you can figure out a way of writing down these parameters of one flyby waveform in terms of those same parameters from the previous flyby waveform, you can create an iterative map that allows you to sum over multiple of these waveforms and construct a full inspiral sequence. I did this work as a graduate student for constructing these iterative maps, which I call timing models, and you end up with something like this. So starting with the time of pericenter passage, the difference between the two times is given by this function of the impact parameter and eccentricity, and you may recognize this as the orbital period of the binary. This comes from an approximation of treating the changes in the orbital elements of the binary as instantaneous at pericenter. So in between pericenter passages, you can treat the orbit as effectively a constant ellipse, a Keplerian ellipse specifically, so that then the time between pericenter passages just simply becomes the orbital period. And I should say that this is an approximation. This is not an exact answer. On the other hand, the evolution of the impact parameter and eccentricity needs to be known from the fluxes of gravitational radiation, and you can calculate these from the balance laws, and they specifically scale like this dimensionless impact parameter to the 5/2 power. The reason for this is that radiation reaction enters at 2.5 PN order, which means it scales like V to the 5, and as a result, you end up with the specific scaling. Now, once you have this timing model, you can ask the question, well, let's compare it to these numerical post-Newtonian waveforms. And so what I did was I generated a 10-burst sequence at an impact parameter of 60 m by just simply numerically integrating the leading post-Newtonian equations of motion. And then I computed the match to the effective flyby waveforms as a function of the number of waveforms in this full inspiral sequence. And the idea was I wanted to see whether the match was maximized at the correct number of waveforms. And here is the result that you get from that match calculation, specifically the black line here. So what you see from this is that the EFBs are capable of recovering the full inspiral sequence, so they predict the correct number of bursts, and they achieve matches that are above 0.97. So that's good. The stitching together of multiple flyby waveforms can accurately track multiple bursts. Now, the main challenge with this is, well, what happens if your timing model isn't 100% accurate? After all, we did have to put in approximations in order to get it to work, in order to construct this thing. And that's what's shown in the blue line here, where I've introduced an artificial 1% error in the timing model. And what you see is that the match no longer gets very high, and it doesn't peak at the correct number of waveforms. So in this case, you could lose detection. And the sort of takeaway from this is that if you really want to go after these sorts of signals, you may need to go beyond on the post-Newtonian parameterization to develop timing models for these sorts of things. Finally, since you have analytic waveforms in the frequency domain, you can consider parameter estimation in a semi-analytic fashion by using a Fisher analysis. The idea here is that your waveform model is characterized by some set of parameters, namely the mass of the system, the symmetric mass ratio, the eccentricity, impact parameter, time of pericenter passage, luminosity distance, inclination angle, and polarization angle. Once you know what these parameters are, you can write down what's called the Fisher information matrix, which is given by the overlap between derivatives of your frequency domain waveform. And because you know what your waveform is analytically, you can calculate these derivatives analytically as well. And then what you do, so this Fisher matrix gives you an approximation of what the posterior probability distribution is on these parameters. So what you can do is calculate the inverse of this Fisher matrix, and then the uncertainty in your parameters is given by the diagonal components of that matrix. Now, one of the caveats to this analysis is that you need to be very careful of degeneracies in your waveform models. And these effective flyby waveforms actually have two degeneracies in them. The first is the chirp mass, which is equal to the total mass of the binary times the symmetric mass ratio to the 3/5 power. And this is known from the quasi-circular waveforms. pretty much all post-Newtonian waveforms leading PN order have this degeneracy, so this is not unexpected. On the other hand, what is unexpected is that there is an additional degeneracy for these flyby waveforms, namely this calligraphic P variable that I call the orbital radius of curvature. Like, this is not something that is present in quasi-circular waveforms and is only present in these effective flyby waveforms. So what I did was I carried out this Fisher analysis for 2,000 systems. I'm only going to show the results for one of them, where I track the uncertainties in the parameters over multiple orbits. So here I have plotted the uncertainty in the chirp mass, which is given by the solid black line, the uncertainty in the orbital radius of curvature, which is given by the dashed line, the eccentricity, which is given by the line with the dots, and the time of pericenter passage, which is given by the line with the crosses. What you see from this, starting on the left, is that with the initial burst, the uncertainties in these parameters are generally large. And this might be somewhat surprising until you remember that the bursts are not actually full. They don't cover a full orbit. So there's not a lot of phase information contained within them. And so you're actually expected to not get very large or very small uncertainties in these parameters. And so you can ask the question, well, how does the uncertainty improve as I include more bursts using this timing model that I showed a couple slides back? And what you see from this is that after the third burst, the uncertainties converge to a monotonically decreasing trend that is very simple. And this is actually not unexpected, because you can study the inverse problem of that timing model, and what you find is that you actually need three bursts in order to completely reconstruct the parameters of the initial burst. So, you know, this is sort of expected. And the takeaway of this is that while it might be possible to detect individual bursts using match filtering, it's probably not ideal to do parameter estimation with single bursts, and you really want to consider the full end spiral sequence. So that's all I have to say in regards to binary black holes. I want to move on now to neutron star binaries, specifically putting in tidal effects into these effective flyby models. And this is work that has largely been championed by my post-bac student, Nihayed Arredondo, pictured here. He will be going off to graduate school soon, and I will be picking up the heavy lifting on this project once he leaves. So, at the beginning of this talk, I said that there are not many numerical relativity waveforms for highly eccentric binaries, but there are some, and most of them have followed or have focused on the black hole neutron star binaries. And an example waveform is given here, where the binary comes from an unbound orbit. It goes through closest approach, emits a burst of radiation, becomes bound, goes through a second orbit, and then it goes through merger and ring down. Now, when I talked about the binary black hole case, I said that there's very little gravitational wave emission during this orbit, that most of the gravitational wave emission comes from these pericenter passages. But if you look at this waveform, you find that there's this oscillatory wave in between the two pericenter passages. And what this thing is not seen in the binary black hole case. And what it actually is it's a result of an F mode that is generated on the neutron star by the tidal interaction between these two objects. Now, this is hard to characterize with numerical relativity waveforms, and instead, it wasn't until very recently that Michel Vick and Dong Lai looked at these F modes from post-Newtonian theory, and what they found was that there are actually three possible configurations of these F modes. So in the first, starting on the top left, you have what I call the non-resonant case, where plotted here is the energy in the mode normalized to the binding energy of the star. And in the non-resonant case, the mode energy undergoes small oscillations. Now, the mode energy, you may notice that it actually decreases from time to time. And the reason for this is that if the phase of the mode is out of phase with respect to the orbit, when you go through a pericenter passage, the mode can actually push energy back into the orbit. So the actual evolution of the mode in the orbit for these highly eccentric binaries is fairly non-trivial. It's not just a simple mode that grows with energy. On the other hand, on the top right, you have the resonant case, where the frequency of the mode is some multiple of the orbital harmonic. And so you have this resonance where the mode energy now undergoes larger oscillations by about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude compared to the non-resonant case. And the structure of this oscillation is significantly simpler. Finally, Vic and Lai showed that there's a third scenario, namely that of chaotic mode. So in this scenario, the energy that is put into the mode in these subsequent pericenter passages can actually be greater than the binding energy of the star. And over many, many orbits, this generally causes the mode energy to increase, becoming an appreciable fraction of the binding energy of the star. And this is probably the most interesting case, but it is not the one that we're working on modeling right now. Right now, we're mostly focusing on the non-resonant case. Now, those calculations on the previous slide didn't include radiation reaction, but fortunately, Vic and Lai did include the 2.5 PN radiation reaction effect and plotted here the amplitude and phase of the time domain waveform, including these tidal interactions and not including them. So just including the leading PN order radiation reaction. And the reason for doing these two different calculations is to calculate how much dephasing you get when you include these tidal interactions. Why do you want to do that? Well, this dephasing tells you whether or not such an effect would be detectable by LIGO. So as a point of reference, if you have a dephasing of about a radian, that would be something that could potentially be detected by LIGO. If it's less than that, you're probably looking at something that's more relevant to ground the third generation detectors. Now, you notice in the bottom panel here, the dephasing between these two evolutions is almost 10 radians. And this is especially important because there have been calculations of these F modes for quasi-circular and low eccentricity binaries, where it was shown that the F mode can be excited in the late stages of the N spiral. And the dephasing in those cases is well below one radian. And so it is usually argued that these F mode effects are not detectable by LIGO, and you really need third generation detectors to observe them. But here, because the impact parameter of the system is so small, it's around 12 m, the dephasing is very large. And this is definitely detectable by LIGO. And Vic and Lai argue that this can be used to place constraints in the neutron star equation of state. Now, I argue that that's kind of obvious, and what you really want to do is construct a model of what these F modes look like and their effect on the orbital phase so that you can then go out and do parameter estimation studies to actually figure out how much better or worse you do compared to the quasi-circular limit. And so I'll give a brief little primer on how you actually calculate the F modes. The idea is that you do first order perturbation theory, where you displace the fluid elements by some perturbation Z, where this perturbation can be decomposed in terms of a time-dependent amplitude Q and a spatial vector Z. And then you go out and you solve this thing by an eigenvalue problem. And if you carry out the calculation to its end state, what you find is that the mode amplitude, where now I've replaced lambda with M because we've decomposed in terms of spherical harmonics, you find that the mode amplitude satisfies this simple harmonic oscillator, where here gamma is the damping coefficient of the mode. There are two possible ways that you can get damping of F modes. One is just direct gravitational wave emission. The other is bulk viscosity in the star. Omega here is the mode frequency for F mode. This is typically in the kilohertz regime. And that's part of the reason why people typically say that F modes are not detectable by LIGO, because LIGO is not very sensitive in the kilohertz regime. And the mode amplitude is sourced by the tidal potential with scales like 1 over R and is dependent upon the orbital phase phi. Now, this is important because the quadrupole moment of the star scales with this time-dependent amplitude, and this is what is referred to as a dynamical tide. This is generally not present in quasi-circular binaries, wherein you have the limit of static tides. So what have we been doing? Well, some work has already been done on F modes and highly eccentric binaries. And these previous work has found that you can decompose the tidal potential in a Fourier decomposition, just like we did with the waveforms for binary black holes, where now you have these XK coefficients that depend on eccentricity, which are called Hansen coefficients. And part of the challenge with doing this calculation is actually figuring out how to analytically evaluate these Hansen coefficients. They can be written down as general Fourier integrals, but evaluating them for arbitrary eccentricity has turned out to be very hard, and we've had to resort to calculating them numerically. Fortunately, this isn't a huge problem for reasons that I will show in a second. Now, if you do this, you can actually solve for the mode amplitude as a function of time. It becomes this function here, and I should say there's an e to the ikl that is missing from this expression, but it's dependent on the Hansen coefficients, and it has this denominator that's dependent upon the mode frequency and damping coefficient. Now, what is the effective flyby point framework stuff here? Well, once again, you have this infinite summation, and what you want to do is resum it. So you can do the same techniques that you did for binary black holes, where you convert the summation to an integral and try to evaluate this thing. Now, fortunately, in this case, you don't need to know what the Hansen coefficients are explicitly, because you can convert that integral over k into a contour integral on the complex plane and just evaluate this thing by the residues from the poles of the denominator. And if you do that, you get this closed form expression for the mode amplitude, which is just basically an exponentially damped sinusoid, where now the Hansen coefficients, rather than being evaluated at these integer harmonics, where k is an integer, k now takes these complex values. And this is part of the reason why we've been evaluating these things analytically, because it's not obvious that you can evaluate these things for non-integer values. Now, that's fine to get a closed form expression, but how does this actually compare to the exact answer of that harmonic oscillator equation? And that's what I plotted here on the left. So the black line is the numerical evolution of the F mode for a binary with impact parameter of 20m and eccentricity 0.9. And what you see is that there's no mode up until the binary comes through pericenter passage at around 3400m. The mode gets excited, and as the system moves away from pericenter passage, it eventually dies down to a steady state. On the other hand, you have the resummed mode, which is given by this gray dashed line. And as you can see, during pericenter passage, it doesn't match the mode at all, but eventually the two solutions converge to one another. And on the right, I have plotted here the residual between these two solutions. And what you see is that once you move away from pericenter, the resummed mode becomes an accurate description of the actual F mode, generated by this tidal interaction. We are still working on quantifying this in terms of matches and trying to figure out whether or not you could use these resummed F modes to try to detect these things. And this is very much in the early stages of this calculation. We have a lot of work to still do in regards to this. So that's really all that I had for you today. I just want to say that this is really the beginning of what is going to be a very long journey of investigating what you can do with these flyby waveforms. And really the first step to doing that is, well, calculating these things to higher post-Newtonian order. The pericenter velocities in these highly eccentric binaries can be very large. So you really do want to consider what post-Newtonian corrections are going to do to them. You can consider whether or not you can probe fundamental physics with these waveforms, and that includes tests of general relativity, as well as constraints on the neutron star equation of state. As I said, we're only in the early stages of considering these neutron star effects, but you need to calculate things like the back reaction of the tides on the orbit. You need to consider resonant tides, but eventually the hope is to be able to place constraints on the equation of state in the neutron star in simulated data analysis studies. And I would also like to see whether or not you can constrain the source of the damping of these modes. Is it due to gravitational waves, or is it due to some sort of bulk viscosity in the star? Chaotic modes are an entirely different beast. And there are some calculations by Vick and Lai that suggest that the mode energy can grow arbitrarily large to the point that you break first order perturbation theory. And so this opens up the question, well, is there something at second order in perturbation theory that prevents this from happening? Or do you really need to consider this in a non-perturbative regime? That's still an open question. You can do most of this tidal dynamics of neutron stars also with exotic compact objects. So you can ask the question, did these dynamical tidal effects allow us to constrain the existence of these exotic compact objects? Finally, there are expected to be many more eccentric signals in the band of space-based detectors. So a lot of these analyses can also be repeated for LISA and decahertz gravitational wave detectors. And so that's all I have for you today. Thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, Nick, for a great talk. Do we have questions for Nick?
I have a quick question. So how do you estimate the number of events that you expect per year towards the end of your previous slide?
You mean here?
Right. So where does that 2,000 number come from? What are the assumptions or what are the mechanisms that you think?
So this 2,000 comes from Monte Carlo simulations of globular clusters that the population synthesis people have been doing. So you take some ensemble, I think they've calculated something like 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 simulations, and you do some ensemble average to get a rough estimate of how many black holes you can expect per typical globular cluster. And then you say, well, there's X amount of globular clusters in the Milky Way, so you expect this amount of black hole binaries within the Milky Way. Whether or not this is actually true remains to be seen.
I see, thanks. And the distribution of those eccentricities would be?
So in the space-based, for space-based observatories, they can satisfy a wide range of eccentricities. So in the decahertz region, the mechanism that dominates black holes there is what are referred to as binary single interactions, where you have a binary and another third object comes in and disrupts the binary, and you get this very chaotic mechanism. There, when they form, they generally form with high eccentricities above 0.5. Lower frequencies in the LISA regime, what happens is these chaotic interactions generally force a steady state is sort of formed where you have a bound binary. And for LISA sources, this bound binary actually gets kicked out of the cluster. And those things can actually form with pretty much the entire range of eccentricity.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Luis. I've seen that Laura had a question, but maybe that question was already answered.
Actually the same question as Luis. So I'm good, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Laura. Any other questions for Nick?
So I have a question and a comment. My question is, so you mentioned for this binary black hole eccentric orbit, right? Like you mentioned that the timing is important, otherwise the fidelity just drops so badly. So do you think it is realistic to get an accurate enough timing model based on PN calculations? So that's my question. My comment is regarding your discussion for the eccentric binary neutron stars. So I don't think the paper by Wiki and Lai was the first one showing that the FMO oscillation is important.
Yes.
I think I wrote a paper with Franz and Will several years ago, and we already showed that the mode transfer to the F mode can be comparable to the mode, comparable to the energy like carried away by the gravitational waves during the burst if the impact parameter is small. So that already shows that the mode oscillation is very important.
Yeah, so I am familiar with your paper with Franz. I only bring up the results of Vic and Lai because they did a fairly thorough analysis that shows that you have these three different possibilities. But yes, you're right that these calculations were done by you and Franz before Michelle Vic and Dong Lai.
Yeah. Later on, I mean, we have another paper doing this quasi-Caperian calculation for the neutron star orbit, and that includes some of the things you mentioned, like the Hansen coefficient and many harmonics. So if you have not read it, maybe you can find some similar discussion there.
I've read your paper, and that's actually how we sort of modeled our calculations of neutron stars off of yours, and that's the reason why we also get these Hansen coefficients. But to answer your question regarding post-Newtonian timing models, my student has already found that the timing model that I presented in this talk is not accurate if the impact parameter is very small. So if you go down to like 20m, the timing model is not accurate anymore. So you need to do something else in post-Newtonian theory to try to develop an accurate timing model. And I think the solution to do this, at least in post-Newtonian theory, is to do a multiple scale analysis. That hasn't been done for eccentric binaries in any rigorous fashion. There are some calculations by De Moore and company that consider post-adiabatic effects beyond the standard balance laws, but those have been carried out to sufficiently high order that you could get an accurate timing model from eccentric binaries. The people who've gotten closest are Cliff Will and his group down in Florida. But I'm not, I don't think that they've gotten far enough to develop that we could take the results and develop a timing model from them. So one of the things that my student is going to be working on next is figuring out if you carry the multiple scale analysis out to sufficiently high order, can you get an accurate enough post-Newtonian timing model? As far as whether or not a post-Newtonian timing model will work compared to realistic signals, that will depend upon the impact parameter. So if the impact parameter is large, like what I showed in that comparison, let me go back a few slides. So here, like the impact parameter was 60 m, and this post-Newtonian timing model works very well. But if you go down to very small impact parameters, post-Newtonian theory is going to break completely, and they're going to need to do something else, maybe like an EOB timing model. And there, I haven't spent enough time exploring as to whether or not you could actually do that with the EOB formalism.
Okay, thanks.
If I could just follow up on Juan's question. So when you're trying to estimate how accurate the post-Newtonian model is, how do you do that? Are you just comparing like, you know, the 2.5 to the 3.5 PN term? Or are you comparing to like a numerical waveform?
So if you want to figure out whether or not, if you want to figure out how important post-Newtonian effects are, that's exactly what you would do. You would compare, you would calculate the thing to 2.5 PN order, then go to 3.5 PN order, do the recalculation and compare the two. So that tells you how important the post-Newtonian contributions are. And unfortunately for eccentric binaries, these things have only been calculated to absolute 3.5 PN order, and you can't go beyond that. There are some calculations that are going ongoing to higher PN order, but they haven't gotten to the stage where we can throw them on a computer and numerically integrate them for eccentric binaries. Here, what I'm doing is comparing a 2.5 PN timing model to a 2.5 PN numerical evolution and just seeing, is the timing model accurate enough to recover that numerical evolution?
And so, I mean, I guess you kind of already said this or addressed this to some extent, but I mean, is there, like, is the post-Newtonian, like, even if you integrate the post-Newtonian results to, you know, get the numerical, quote unquote, numerical waveform. I mean, are those going to be accurate enough for what you need to detect these things with LIGO? I mean, given how sensitive the, you know, the timing between bursts is to the amount of energy that's radiated in each burst.
So I have not done that comparison. And once again, this depends on the impact parameter. If the impact parameter is very small, we know post-Newtonian theory is going to break down. Yeah, but I haven't estimated that.
Okay, thanks. And thanks for the nice talk.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks, Will. We have a question from Reed.
Yeah, thanks. I was wondering if you don't mind, if you could elaborate on your thoughts on the higher order terms you were talking about. If the, you know, F mode amplitude becomes larger, then you might need to consider other things. This was at the very end of your talk.
Yeah, so I can't elaborate in any great detail because this is something that I just learned about like 2 weeks ago. I have a suspicion that this is not a perturbative effect. So there have been some calculations of fluid perturbations of Newtonian stars to second order in perturbation theory, but they have not considered the coupling of F modes to themselves. They've instead considered the coupling of F modes to P modes to G modes. And they've shown that there is this sort of strange instability that arises. So it is possible that there is some sort of instability that exists between the self-coupling of F modes to each other at second order in perturbation theory, but I don't have any intuition as to whether or not that does actually exist. And I have a suspicion that this is something that's actually going to be need to be solved in the full nonlinear problem using some sort of numerical simulation.
Okay, thanks. So the reason I bring it up is because this problem of an effect like you described has been explored at some length in the exoplanet community. With the idea of, you know, strong tides around their Newtonian main sequence stars, but big planets orbiting those. And you can find things like F modes or low order G modes coupling to typically other G modes and then effectively damping out that the behavior of that mode. And you can get modified dynamics. Anyway, so I was just wondering if you knew about that rather than the PG secular instabilities that have been focused on in neutrons. But anyway, maybe we can follow up offline.
I'm vaguely familiar with this instability in exoplanets. And I should say that the calculations of Vick and Lai mostly focus on exoplanets. For neutron stars, their calculations seem to suggest that radiation reaction of the orbit generically damps out the F modes before they become too large. But you know, their simulations were a restricted PN problem. And I think that if we really want to get a handle on these sorts of things, we need to repeat it to the full extent of our knowledge of post-Newtonian theory.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Reed. Any final questions or thoughts?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the effect of the F mode in the eccentric binaries are more detectable than in circular binaries. Could you explain more about that? Why is that?
So the problem with F modes is that you need the tidal potential to be very strong and rapidly varying in order to get the F modes to be excited to large enough amplitude to be detected. In quasi-circular binaries, this doesn't happen until the last few orbits of the N spiral. And so there, the amount of phase offset that introduces is very small, typically like a hundredth of a radian. And this was shown by Wan Yang's calculations some years ago. He also showed that if there is a resonance, you get a significantly larger dephasing, but that is still mostly of relevance to third generation detectors. On the other hand, if you look at these highly eccentric binaries, you can get impact parameters to be very small. And those very small impact parameters are actually what enhance these tidal effects and make them observable by LIGO.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Any final questions or thoughts? Okay, if not, then let's thank Nicholas again for this great talk. Thanks a lot.